Before we begin, everyone do me a favor.
Thanks.
Read a little thing I wrote called the Federalist Papers.
Yeah.
I explain how a nation's unlikely to survive without a strong central government to keep it alive. When I launched a central bank, Jefferson called me ill. Now you have my face to thank on every $10 bill. When America was cash-strapped, I pushed past that. Now some sicko makes crypto, and our nation backtracks.
Decentralized currency, yes, I invented it. I'm sure many governments wish they had prevented it. The national cash is how they keep control. But freedom to the people was my ultimate goal. Am I a pseudonym, a group of men? It doesn't even matter.
Nope.
I invented Bitcoin because fiat is a disaster. A man from Japan or a damn hologram. I'm the reason open season on crypto began.
Does anybody know?
Welcome. You're listening to the Tokens Radio Show. It's Tuesday, March the 11th. My name's Christy.
I'm Linda.
And we're broadcasting from the KCNR studios in Redding, California, here on the dial at 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, and streaming online at KCNR1460.com. You can follow us on X at Tokens Radio Show for updates and commentary, or to shoot us a message. We're in there quite a bit.
And we try to be.
Yeah. Hey, Ben, welcome.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Ben's in the house. Man, everything is just so organized when we come in here. It's great.
Thank you. I like to be organized.
Yeah. Well, it shows. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. It makes life really nice.
No problem.
Well, thank you. You're going to enjoy the show, Ben. We got a lot of stuff that's going on here, a lot of moving parts. So jump in if you like.
Yeah, it's fast moving tonight.
So, my gosh, so much news. Trump signed an executive order, starting a strategic reserve, an asset wealth fund. So our show is packed, focused on what might be Bitcoin's biggest milestone yet, was setting up the strategic Bitcoin reserve.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take you from the fundamentals as to why Bitcoin exists in the historic executive order signed last Friday, with insights from Treasury Secretary Bessent, Michael Saylor, and International Perspectives. Later, we'll hear from Ohio gubernatorial candidate Vivek Ramaswamy. He was a former presidential candidate.
Yes, he was.
But he jumped on the opportunity to serve the folks of Ohio. So he'll be here on how Bitcoin could transform economic thinking, and you don't want to miss this comprehensive look at what many are calling a watershed moment for Bitcoin adoption. But first, before we get into that, let's have a market update and a word from our sponsor.
All right, and before I do the market update, I just want to say, and hopefully it'll help people understand why certain events have happened.
Sure. Yeah.
And what it could lead to. And with that, we will go with the market. Bitcoin is at $82,996.86.
Don't let the ouch hurt you. Just hang in there.
Bye.
Exactly.
IBIT ETF is at $47.24. ETH is at $1,920.
$2,000.
Yeah.
It hasn't been like that in a while.
It's kind of interesting. XRP, $219. And MicroStrategy is at $260.59.
XRP still holding its own for quite a while.
It
was just right around 48 cents, 50 cents, and here it is, stayed over the $2 barrier.
Yep. I don't think it's going to, you know, dip too much lower than that, but you never know with what's going on. Okay. Our friends at the Queen of Dragons, home to Pinnacle Cultivators, sponsors today's show. Their carefully cultivated, unique strands offer elevated experience with exotic genetics and robust flavors. The Queen of Dragons is known for fair pricing, stringent quality control, and knowledgeable staff. Stay connected by following at Queen Dragons on X or call them 530-276-9771.
Yeah, before we get to this week's breaking news, let's start with some fundamentals, shall we? So what problem is Bitcoin designed to solve? This brief overview explains why Bitcoin was created and why it's important for the average person's financial well-being. This is really good.
Yeah.
What do we got to do, Charles? We got to fix the money.
Well, how do we fix the money?
We got to adopt Bitcoin. We have to have a money that cannot be inflated and manipulated and something that is controlled by rulers. We need a system governed by rules. Math. backed by energy. That's what Bitcoin is.
What do you make of the rapidness of the adoption? Just more people saying, hey, this and this might be the answer.
People are really seeing this as a global macro asset, the best savings technology. You know, we talk about this a lot for the working class,
right,
to restore the American dream, but also to uplift people economically around the entire world. It's so important because inflation has sucked the life and the hopes of the future for so many people. And Bitcoin, I really do believe, is the fix.
And it's not just in America. It's around the world. You've talked about impoverished nations, that this is the key for them to get out of that situation.
This is a bottom-up phenomenon. This is a working-class movement. How many technologies come around that empower the CEOs and the folks in the boardrooms, but also those people that are working, that are struggling, that are in developing nations?
Right.
Plus, when you think about technology, it should be deflationary, but that deflation's not flowing to us, the workers. With something like Bitcoin that, again, can never be inflated, that can actually allow people to save for the future. Why do I have to work for something that someone else can print? I don't want that. That's why we have so many quintillionaires in this wealth concentration, because it's a broken system at the core. And
right,
let's stop fighting over the symptoms. Let's address the core systemic issue. Let's fix the money.
Let's fix the money.
Let's fix
yeah,
the money.
Well said.
Yeah.
Like so many things. Let's get to the core problem. Let's not just put some icing on the cake, okay?
Yeah, inflation seems to be the central topic in everything right
yep,
now.
It is.
And she also said the bottom-up phenomenon, which is just amazing. When you'll hear in some of the other cuts that we have tonight about being able to front-run the government ahead on something, which is what we've been able to do, and this is part of the bottom-up phenomenon that she was speaking about.
She also said, remember, a lot of people don't look at money this way. It, you know, it's done by rules, math, and energy.
Exactly.
Little bit different take on things.
Bitcoin's energy.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Well, with that context in mind, let's turn to the historic announcement that has the financial world buzzing. Last Friday, President Trump, you may have heard, signed an executive order establishing a strategic Bitcoin reserve, an unprecedented move at most that signals a major shift in how the United States government views this digital asset. So why don't we go ahead and hear a short cut of him announcing, or it being announced, while he is signing.
Signing it.
Okay, here we go.
Today we're signing, this is a very historic, an executive order establishing a strategic Bitcoin reserve and
right,
digital asset stockpile. This is a promise that you made throughout the campaign, and today we're keeping that promise. The reserve will be capitalized with Bitcoin that the federal government already owns, so it won't cost taxpayers a dime. This is like a digital Fort Knox for digital gold, and premature sales of Bitcoin over the past years cost American taxpayers over $17 billion in lost value because we didn't have a long-term strategy.
Right.
Now we do, though.
And this is something you believe in?
100%, yeah.
Okay.
And the whole community believes in it.
Very good. And I made the promise, right?
Absolutely.
Some yeah, major drops there. You know, digital Fort Knox for digital gold.
Yes.
And the biggie. We lost $17 billion in lost value with the Bitcoin that we had sold.
Yes, because we sold it.
That's correct, rather than holding on to it.
Yeah, I don't think people realize that we sold a big
yeah,
chunk off.
So that we would have been $17 billion ahead
mm-hmm,
and well established in our strategic wealth fund, but they're going to get there.
But there is ways to get there.
They're going to get there.
Yes,
that's for
they
sure
are.
Yeah.
All right. That executive order represents a seismic shift in the U.S. monetary policy. But how are industry leaders responding to this historic announcement?
Yeah. In this, a lot of ways,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, we were talking about it before we come on air about confidence and all of that mm-hmm, and the people and the industry. And,
right.
And so hopefully we'll get to more of that. In this next clip, we'll hear from the Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick, and Bitcoin advocate Michael Saylor, we love Michael
yeah,
Saylor, explaining why Bitcoin specifically, rather than other cryptocurrencies, makes sense for a national strategic reserve. So let's take a listen to this.
The dust has settled after Trump's questionable post on Sunday, where he mentioned a peculiar basket of crypto that would apparently be in the reserve. Trump's Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick gave a statement to the press yesterday where he suggested that Bitcoin would receive unique status under Trump's plan. Lutnick said, quote, a Bitcoin strategic reserve is something the president's interested in. He spoke about it all during the campaign trail, and I think you're going to see it executed on Friday. He continued, so Bitcoin is one thing, and then the other currencies, the other crypto tokens, I think will be treated differently. It's also very notable that ahead of Friday's summit, the founders of the three biggest US-based retail crypto exchanges, Coinbase, Kraken, and Gemini, all signaled they prefer a Bitcoin-only reserve, if there's one at all. And then there's perhaps the most influential attendee to the summit, Michael Saylor, whose company Strategy owns 2.4% of the entire Bitcoin supply, holding just shy of 500,000 Bitcoin. Saylor was on Fox Business yesterday giving his opinion on the reserve and outlining the clear delineation between different digital assets being proposed.
Do you think taxpayer money should be used to purchase these tokens and coins to fill the reserve?
Well, I think the way to think about the industry is there's digital commodities, that's Bitcoin, an asset without an issuer. There's digital currencies, like the stable coins, that's really important for U.S. dollar supremacy and digital commerce. There are digital securities, like tokenized stocks and bonds, that will actually provide a capital efficiency and globalization for American securities. And then there are digital tokens, assets with issuers that provide digital utility that are very interesting and compelling. Their role is capital creation for the small and mid-sized companies that are blocked from the capital markets right now. I think that it's wise to capitalize a country or a company on a commodity, an asset without an issuer, something like a property. You could buy oil. Bitcoin is a commodity. I think that digital
is attached to a company, Ripple.
I think that those are tokens, and we should have a regulatory framework to allow them to be issued because
issued,
you know,
but in the reserve? Should they be in the reserve?
I think the emerging consensus in the industry is that Bitcoin should be the element in a strategic reserve over the long term for the country. But if you wanted to support various investments in a sovereign wealth fund, that would be up to the executive
branch. Okay, so let's be clear. I'm hearing you say the reserve fund should really have the tested one, and that is Bitcoin, and not Solana or Cardano.
And the important thing to keep in mind is Bitcoin is the one universally agreed upon foundational asset in the entire crypto economy because it's the asset without an issuer. It's neutral. 99% of the energy and the capital has flown into that one.
So as Saylor points out, the consensus in the broader industry is that Bitcoin is the only one that makes sense in the reserve due to the fact that it's an asset without an issuer and the only one considered to be commodity-like.
Yeah, that's huge. And I like how he broke it down because he's not saying Bitcoin only. He's really come a long way to understand that there are other use cases for tokens and other cryptos, such as a digital token being an asset with an issuer backed by a digital utility. You know, that's an interesting take.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, like you say, like how he broke it down, because I don't think people realize that in the cryptocurrency world, if you want to call it that, that there's different applications for different things, and that doesn't mean that you're going to use all Bitcoin or you're going to use all, you know, XRP what I mean? There's different applications for different things, like he broke it down into four different categories, basically.
Yeah. So the token being for capital creation, the security, the digital security would be an asset with an issuer, and that's the consistency outside of the commodity that they're all issued by an issuer. And but that's backed by security or commodity. And then digital currency, also an asset with an issuer.
Yeah, but an issuer. That's,
yes,
there's
like
a great
Ripple,
difference, yes.
Backed by currency, like your stable coins, perhaps XRP, and that's for digital commerce and dollar supremacy. And that's the things can run on the blockchain and run automatically, smart contracts. And then digital commodity, an asset without an issuer. That's Bitcoin.
That's the big difference.
It's backed by digital power for capital preservation and appreciation.
Yep. A natural energy.
Yes.
Natural energy. So hopefully that helps some people because that's a big difference. Like I say, after we broke it down and we went over that understanding because they're going, Bitcoin and it's all going to go away and he's got ETH in there. There's reasons. There's reasons.
Yeah. And it took a long time to get to that point. If you want to review his digital asset strategy, it's only a few pages, fairly simple to read. And mind you, it's taken several years for him to to dumb this down, and I say that with all due respect, to get it to a point to where it's easily understood, because it's now been delineated for what these use cases are. And you can go to michael.com, and that would be Michael Saylor's personal website, and you'll see the digital asset strategy right there prominently placed on the front page.
Yep. Good stuff.
It is really good stuff. So, you know, those insights from Michael Saylor highlight why Bitcoin stands apart in the crypto space, just like we just talked about. Mm-hmm. But to understand the significance of the Bitcoin reserve, we need to look at the numbers. In this next clip that we have for you, we'll hear about the U.S. government's previous Bitcoin holdings and what might have been if they held on to them. So this is a short 50-second clip.
So here we go.
Trump's AI and crypto czar David Sacks posted this banger on X today. Over the past decade, the federal government sold approximately 195,000 Bitcoin for proceeds of $366 million. If the government had held the Bitcoin, it would be worth over $17 billion today. That's how much it has cost American taxpayers not to have a long-term strategy. Matt Hogan, CIO of Bitwise, wrote this in a memo to investors this week. After the dust settles, I suspect the final reserve will be nearly entirely Bitcoin, and it will be larger than people think. Besides clarity on regulation and policy regarding all digital assets, it's still unclear if meaningful plans regarding a Bitcoin strategic reserve will be announced tomorrow or not. Regardless, one thing is crystal clear. The Overton window has shifted massively in regards to Bitcoin on the global geopolitical stage. And the fact that these types of conversations are happening at the highest levels of government is a massive deal.
Yep. You know... I wanted to go back to the previous clip, and one thing that, did you notice that Michael Saylor would not commit to the answer or the question he was asked, should taxpayers buy Bitcoin for the strategic reserve?
Right. It should it be the only thing.
He pivoted around that question. He just, I mean, it was so blatant. That he just, it sounded very politician-like.
I was going to say, he was doing the political dance up there with that one, and he's usually pretty straightforward.
And that was just a reiteration of what David Sacks was saying about the 195,000 Bitcoin that were sold and with no long-term strategy.
Yeah, they didn't leverage it. They didn't do anything, which, you know, that's another thing with what's being put in place is to leverage it instead of just outright sell it. I mean, you can do a lot with it.
Sure.
Instead of just, you know, get rid of it. And, yeah. So, given the history of missed opportunities, how does the Treasury Department plan to approach Bitcoin going forward? Here's the Treasury Secretary Bessent explaining the strategy for building the reserve without burdening the taxpayers, like we're kind of talking
about.
Here we
go. So here we go.
Here's
the answer.
Here it is.
Okay, Bitcoin. The reserve. Supposedly there is disappointment that we're not going to be buying Bitcoin outright using taxpayer dollars. But if we can do it in a revenue neutral way, we would. Number one, were you a proponent for the reserve? And two, is there a way to buy Bitcoin, not just acquire it through, I don't know, however we've gotten these $17 billion worth at this point.
Yeah, so Joe, I am a big proponent of the U.S. taking the worldwide lead in crypto. I think we have to bring it onshore and use our best practices and regulation. I think that the Bitcoin reserve, before you can accumulate it, you have to stop selling it. So what we have now is from a seized asset pool, and I wasn't there when it happened, but I believe what happened was about 500 million of Bitcoin was seized, half of it was sold, and what we have now that, you know, say it's over 10 billion, 10, 12 billion, that's all through appreciation. So the first thing to do is to stop the selling. So we are going to, you know, after the victims are paid and all of that, any seized assets will go into this reserve, and then, you know, we'll see what the way forward is for more acquisitions for the reserves. Mm-hmm. And we're starting with Bitcoin, but it's an overall crypto reserve.
Right. So how do you think about buying, though? And how should taxpayers think about that? Because effectively we'll be levering ourselves to some degree, given that we don't have a surplus of money right now, to make these investments.
Yeah, so that's why the first step is to stop selling, and then we're going to put a plan in place from there. So we're having this crypto summit. I'm going back to Washington this afternoon, and then we'll talk about the way forward.
Well, meanwhile, the U.S. is making headlines. It's worth noting that even smaller nations are already been pioneers in adopting Bitcoin as a strategic asset. We were talking about El Salvador and Bhutan.
Bhutan.
So we got a little short clip here about El Salvador and Bhutan, and they've been at the forefront, but not without some pushback from the international financial institutions like the IMF.
Yeah, imagine that. No, the IMF is not happy with this whole Bitcoin thing going on at all.
They don't like it.
No, they don't like it at all.
Yes. Okay.
So let's take a listen.
All right.
Smaller nations like El Salvador and Bhutan were the earliest movers in this monetary revolution. The Prime Minister of Bhutan spoke with Al Jazeera recently about his nation's experience in Bitcoin mining.
In Bhutan, gold is everywhere, a Buddhist symbol of the everlasting nature of enlightenment. Now this small Himalayan kingdom is investing in a future it hopes will be blessed with what backers call digital gold, Bitcoin. It's also finite and supposedly everlasting.
There are hundreds of people who have made billions of dollars on the back of Bitcoin. Why aren't governments doing more?
Prime Minister Chering Topgay says Bitcoin is a strategic reserve, one currently worth more than $1 billion.
We have used Bitcoin for health, provide free healthcare, for our environment, but these are minor. The main use of Bitcoin has been to finance the salaries of public servants.
Well, Mr. Prime Minister, it seems like governments around the world have finally gotten the memo. Like El Salvador, who became the first country in the world to make Bitcoin legal tender in 2021 and has since been adding to their own strategic reserve, today holding over 6,000 Bitcoin. However, the Latin American nation's Bitcoin future is uncertain, as a recent agreement with the IMF explicitly prohibits them from continuing to use public funds to purchase additional Bitcoin as part of a $3.5 billion loan to help service their ballooning debt. But the president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele, confusingly continues to purchase additional Bitcoin nearly every day since the agreement has been signed. He even posted on X, insinuating that El Salvador's Bitcoin purchases would not stop. So either he's found some sort of loophole, or he's outright defying the IMF and breaking the agreement.
Do you think he just conveniently forgot, or defiantly? I mean, didn't he do this a couple of years ago with the IMF when he paid back the loan early?
Yeah, he kind of gave them...
And he,
the stink eye.
Yeah, and the IMF gave him the stink eye for having Bitcoin, and now this, they've come back for another loan, and now this is a way to try to leverage what they want from El Salvador.
Yeah.
They don't like El Salvador being independent.
They don't like anybody being independent.
No.
That's why they're having such a rub with everything that's going on.
Because
they know where it's headed. If people realize it, what's going to happen?
Right.
You know? All right, so I think this is a good place for us to take a break. You are listening to Tokens Radio Show on 1460 AM and 96.5 FM, and we'll see you in a few minutes.
Experience glowing wild and illuminated Wildlife Lantern Festival at the Sundial Bridge and Turtle Bay Exploration Park in Redding, California. Open select nights April 4th through June 8th, 7 to 10 p.m. Featuring 10 acres of illuminated gardens filled with Asian lanterns inspired by plants and animals from around the world. Plus food, drinks, live performances on select nights, and much more. Don't miss Turtle Bay's Glowing Wild Lantern Festival at the Sundial Bridge. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Hi friends, RC here with Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. Henry Clay, Warhawk, Rebellious. Backed by popular demand, this limited edition Toro is sure to please. Another fine example of Nicaraguan tobacco blended by AJ Fernandez. Complex, smooth, chocolatey Habano wrapper, a satisfying smoke with a clean finish. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
Owners, landlords, and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com.
Hello, food fans. Chef Cal DiMercurio here, inviting you to tune in each Wednesday for an hour of helping you turn the drudgery of preparing home meals into having fun in the kitchen. We'll be sharing tips, tricks, and tempting insights that are sure to make your time in the kitchen a pleasant and fulfilling one. Come join me and my wife Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. at Cooking Like a Pro, right here on KCNR 1460.
Good day. Welcome to this week's Town Hall News Brief. I'm Phoebe Johnson, your host, to provide the latest local updates. In a sweeping cost-cutting measure, the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, has targeted over 60 federal agency leases for cancellation across California, including 7 in the North State and North Coast regions. The affected offices span Redding, Yreka, Mount Shasta, Weaverville, Chico, Eureka, and Arcata, housing essential services like the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Forest Service, and Small Business Administration. These Northern California closures represent $623,779 in projected savings, part of a nationwide initiative terminating 748 federal facility leases, eliminating 9.5 million square feet of government space, and saving $660 million. DOGE, established under President Trump's administration and led by Elon Musk, continues its mission to reduce federal spending through lease terminations, agency cutbacks, and contract cancellations. Implementation timelines remain unclear. As federal agencies prepare to shutter offices across Northern California, Redding residents are taking action. Citizens for a Better Redding is collecting signatures for a November ballot measure proposing a 1% sales tax increase to fund public safety, roads, and parks, addressing the city's $5 million deficit. Despite protests from cannabis business owners, the city council voted 3-2 to increase cannabis taxes. Sales tax from 5% to 6%, manufacturing processing from 3% to 4%, and cultivation from $3 to $5 per square foot. The council also voted 4-1 to maintain Redding Sports Park operations for 2 years, potentially partnering with the California Soccer Park nonprofit for food service. They unanimously agreed to ask Shasta County to remove conditions from its $100,000 commitment to United Airlines' Denver flight service. Shifting our focus to public safety concerns across the county, leaders from 6 Shasta County public safety organizations detailed significant operational challenges during a special Board of Supervisors meeting on February 27, 2025. The 3-hour summit, attended by approximately 100 people, revealed common struggles across agencies, insufficient staffing, low salaries, and overwhelming workloads. Sheriff Michael Johnson identified jail overcrowding as his department's primary obstacle, while District Attorney Stephanie Bridget highlighted prosecutor caseload significantly higher than comparable counties. Public Defender Ashley Jones reported 20 attorneys handling over 6,000 active cases, with 9 departures last year attributed to non-competitive salaries. Court Executive Fowler Bradley noted increasing caseloads despite funding reductions. Redding Police Chief Barner described staffing reductions, while Probation Officer Neal detailed supervision and rehabilitation programs for offenders. A follow-up meeting is scheduled for March 24th. And ending on a delicious note for our local food enthusiasts, Daniel Monaghan recently opened Blue Door Bagel in Shasta Lake, specializing in New York-style boiled bagels. The shop offers plain, sesame, pretzel, poppy seed, 3 cheese, and jalapeno cheddar varieties at $2.50 each or $24 per dozen. The menu features several bagel sandwiches, with the breakfast bagel, egg, sausage, tomato, and cheddar being the most popular. Other options include lox, veggie, turkey, pizza, and Reuben varieties, ranging from $5.50 to $10. Monaghan, who previously apprenticed at Giz Lane Bakery, uses barley syrup in the boiling process and high-protein flour. The bagels are hand-rolled and baked in a stone oven. Blue Door Bagel operates Tuesday through Saturday at 4237 Shasta Dam Boulevard in Shasta Lake, offering both takeout and dine-in options. Before we go, looking for more local stories? We've got you covered. Find additional news and updates on our social media. Join the conversation at Shasta Lake Town Hall on Facebook or at Town Hall News on X. From all of us at Town Hall Brief, thanks for listening.
You see, this ketchup is a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
What I'm talking about,
yeah?
Yeah.
He's a complicated man, but no one understands him but his woman.
John Jay.
Welcome back. It's kind of an inside joke, folks, okay, on the music tonight, so we'll just leave it at that. All right, before we went to break, we were discussing how countries like El Salvador and Bhutan have been at the forefront, but not without pushback, again, from the international financial institutions like the IMF.
Oh, yeah, our good old friends at the International Monetary Fund.
They push back at anything that's not in, you know, that they don't have control over, don't understand, or think they're going to lose control.
That's the key, control.
Control. Yeah. So now that we understand the geopolitical landscape around national Bitcoin adoption, let's turn to what this might mean for Bitcoin's price and market outlook. I know that's going through a lot of people's head because of the price has been going kind of up a little bit, but down.
Yeah.
You
know? We have some theories about that. We'll talk about it at the end of the show.
Right. Yeah. History suggests that under certain monetary conditions, Bitcoin can experience dramatic price appreciation in relatively short time frames. So let's take
to give you an idea of how fast this thing can move when the money printer is turned on, here's a post from BitPain on X. On October 16th, 2020, the Bitcoin price was $11,500. Just 126 days later, on February 19th, 2021, it was $57,500, an increase of 5x. This corresponds to a weekly compounded growth rate of 9.4% sustained over 18 weeks. A comparable move today would take us to $435,000 by July 8th. Another chart I love is Bitcoin priced in gold. With gold's historic rally over the last year, Bitcoin is still just knocking on the door of the previous all-time high from late 2021. It's looking primed for a breakout. This again makes me think that this entire run up to 100K was just the first inning of this bull run. Gold historically runs first and Bitcoin runs after. If history repeats, expect the second half of this year to get wild.
I think that's going to happen for a number of reasons that we'll talk about towards the end of the show. But
yes.
What's going on, we believe, folks, what's happening right now in real time, what we're experiencing, is planned to get prices down. This is what the mandate was all about when Trump came in and why the tariffs are operating the way that they are. We'll go into that a little
bit.
Yeah,
and that's
later.
The plan kind of across the board is to bring prices down in a lot of categories.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So what strikes me is, where am I? Did I just... lose my spot.
No, looking beyond price predictions.
Yep, that's mine. Yep. So looking beyond these price predictions, we have a lot of cuts, so I got a little confused there.
Yeah, sometimes technology doesn't work quite right.
We always have tech problems. A slight digression. You hear that little buzz? Yeah,
yes.
That's a tech problem.
It is a tech problem.
So Bitcoin's implications extend far beyond price movements, as we well know. So we're going to hear next from Vivek Ramaswamy. He's running for Ohio governor, current candidate.
Oh, yeah.
And he's speaking with Anthony Pompliano here. It's a long interview. We pulled about 5 to 7 minutes out of it. It's pretty good stuff. And Ramaswamy shares how Bitcoin might change economic thinking and become a standard for investment decisions. So here we go. It's about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
I believe we're going to see more and more institutions, including companies, and then eventually state actors as well, view the Bitcoin standard as sort of their hurdle rate to say that if I'm going to invest in something else internally in terms of projects, it better beat the rate of return of, say, some fixed supply asset like Bitcoin. I see it as a new era of capital discipline and a new era of fiscal and monetary policy discipline for the United States, which is what I'm in this for. I believe that's a good thing for our country as well.
What strikes me about that as a perspective is how it positions Bitcoin beyond just an investment vehicle.
Yeah.
You know, Ramaswamy, that's quite the name. I hope I said that halfway right.
Let's just call him Vivek.
Yeah, Vivek. Connects us to our broader economic challenges. And so in this next clip, We're going to, it's about a minute and 33 seconds. It goes a little bit further into this.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
So let's take a listen.
We've got a national debt crisis approaching epic proportions in our country, where the interest payments on our national debt are soon going to be the largest line item on our federal budget. They're already bigger than the entire defense budget. We're going to have to think in the future about what that means for tying the hands, or at least providing competition to the Federal Reserve and to central banks, and frankly, other Western countries as well, that have run on hyperdrive for too long. Eventually, people are going to look to those alternatives. Historically, if you look through most of world history, that alternative has existed in the form of gold. But there you have different questions about physical supply, storage. Now we have a new finite supply, and I think that that's really important. Separating a low-resolution discussion about crypto broadly versus Bitcoin, a fixed supply asset that is mathematically defined, that frankly, not only individuals, but now corporations, you're beginning to see the rise of Bitcoin treasury companies, other institutions are beginning to understand this is a form of capital discipline. That's where the future is headed, and I do think it's in the self-interest of the United States and, frankly, individual states as well to be able to realize that before they're just jumping on the train too late. In some sense, it's better to jump on late than never, but I do think when you think about fiscal discipline and the role that Bitcoin is going to play, it is an alternative. It is an opt-out. It is something that, therefore, holds the feet to the fire of central banks, holds the feet to the fire of the U.S. dollar itself in a way that's actually constructive for the U.S. dollar to have that type of competition where you can't turn on the printing machine with Bitcoin in the same way that you can with a fiat currency.
Yeah, that's quite a bit, quite a bold vision, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So a bold vision for Bitcoin's role in the fiscal discipline, or fiscal discipline, I should say. One aspect I found particularly compelling was Vivek's observation about Bitcoin's unusual adoption pattern. Unlike traditional financial innovations that start with institutions, mm-hmm. Bitcoin flourished from the ground up.
From the people.
From the people. Just started off with some code, creating some tokens, and seeing if some pizza, if the transaction could be done, could I buy some pizza with some Bitcoin?
And that's the whole premise behind it, is the people and freedom.
Yeah.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is.
So we have some information on that from Vivek's perspective from bottom-up adoption. So let's take a listen.
One of the things that I know you've talked quite a bit about is there's been like a centralization of power, but there's also been a hollowing out of American manufacturing, of the middle class in the United States. And a lot of that has come from this pursuit of cheap products, cheap labor, globalization, and what I think Bitcoin has probably done that no other technology that I can think of is that it was a bottoms-up story. A lot of the people in the lower socioeconomic classes were able to go ahead and acquire this before the large financial institutions, before the corporations, before the nation states. And so how does that play into now the largest pools of capital playing in an asset where when they start to buy, when they start to participate, it will actually enrich the people, not the large institutions, not the large corporations? It's like a very fascinating bottoms-up technology story that is really coming on the heels of a 50-year, you know, plus trend of hollowing out of that middle class.
That will be the case, Pomp, so long as overregulation doesn't get in the way. I mean, historically, a lot of what the financial regulatory, especially the federal but also state-level apparatus has done is in the name of helping the very people they seek to protect, they actually end up making it far worse off for those very people they are protecting by stopping them from participating in some of the areas that people in higher income strata are able to. So assuming we continue to operate under the caveat that there's not going to be artificial constraints that stop people at every end of the socioeconomic stratum from participating, and I'm optimistic about that. I don't see things headed that way right now. Then yes, I think you're right. This can be actually a unifying force that lifts up Americans of all stripes, of all backgrounds. I also think that beyond just the pie in the sky, you know, vision, I think that very pragmatically, look at the environment that we're in with respect to capital discipline. We're not in a fiscal and even financial markets environment anymore of just turning on the money printing machine and having effectively zero cost money. You know, you saw that for a lot of startups, a lot of stock market got addicted to that zero interest rate environment. That's not where we are right now.
Well, this bottom-up adoption, you know, is the reason Bitcoin is, you know, distinct. It's its distinctive feature. It really is. We were talking about a bottom-up, not top-down. And it's a big deal because we've been top-down for over 50 years, like he said, you know. So let's return.
Well, I love where he says that government hurts people by protecting them. So really, when do the people get enriched? That was Pomp's question. I'd say when the government stops hurting people by protecting them.
Yeah, it goes back to not everything appears as it seems to appear. Yeah. You know, the government is always saying we're here to help.
Yeah, for some reason there are governmental leaders that just think that they can make better decisions for our own personal governance. It's just insane.
Yeah, and they make these like the border crossings and stuff like that make it seem like they really care about the people. But again, no.
Yeah.
So let's return to Vivette. I'm not going to say concept of the Bitcoin standard as an investment benchmark. And Bitcoin's future and hurdle rate.
I believe we're
framework.
Going to see more and more institutions, including companies, and then eventually state actors as well, view the Bitcoin standard as sort of their hurdle rate to say that if I'm going to invest in something else internally in terms of projects, it better beat the rate of return of, say, some fixed supply asset like Bitcoin. And so I do think that that's going to become more normalized. We're already seeing the early stages of it and the confluence of that bottom-up need and desire for financial freedom and participation by the everyman, but combined with institutions also becoming more rigorous, I think could really be a new era for Bitcoin ahead. And from where I sit, that's great that it's a new era for Bitcoin, but I see it as a new era of capital discipline and a new era of fiscal and monetary policy discipline for the United States, which is what I'm in this for. I believe that's a good thing for our country as well.
Oh, I couldn't agree more.
No.
Yeah, beyond the economic aspects, what caught my attention was how Vivek draws parallels between Bitcoin's underlying ethos and broader cultural values. And that's important.
It is very important.
Some people want to change the ethos of Bitcoin by trying to make it simpler, by trying to consolidate it, but that's away from the ethos. It's to remain decentralized. And that's just one example. It's in a conversation I was having with somebody the other day that we don't need some big old master node to run everything.
No.
It goes against everything.
Ethos.
That's
right. Yes, it goes against the whole reasoning for Bitcoin.
Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and hear what he has to say about the Bitcoin ethos. And
okay.
I'm sure it will be eloquent as Vivek is.
Yeah, the ethos is such an important point, right? I think half the, you know, aspect of leadership as a president or a governor is about the policy agenda you drive, and that's important. But the other half is the character of leadership, the cultural tone that you set for the people you lead. It applies even in a company or in another institution. It certainly applies at the level of a state or a nation. We're not victims. We're victors. That's who we are. And I think that what's happened over the course of the last, you could say, number of decades, is we grew, whether it's in our educational system or in our financial system or our economic policies, to celebrate victimhood over excellence. And what we're doing here is leading a movement. This is part of that Bitcoin ethos of embracing the pursuit of excellence. That is who we are. Embracing success without apologizing for it. My message earlier this week to every son and daughter of Ohio, including my two sons here, is that the American dream is your birthright as an American and as an Ohioan. A world-class education is your birthright. Success is your birthright. Freedom was our heritage and excellence is our destiny. That's who we are. That's a statement of character. And I think that's what makes, by the way, America particularly unique is that we're not just a nation founded on a lineage or a bloodline. We're a nation founded on a set of ideals that bring us together in this homeland, this place we call home, that infuses this place with that sense of purpose and meaning and identity. That is the American spirit. And that's part of why I am a fan of anything that helps revive us, help us remind us of who we are, that spirit of excellence, boundlessness, exceptionalism. Without apology, right? We've been taught to apologize for excellence. No longer. Don't apologize for success. And that's not one form of success. It doesn't mean you have to pursue a four-year college degree. You could pursue it through a path to becoming a plumber or an electrician or a mechanic or a welder. It doesn't matter. The paths to success are plural. Every path open to every child, built on the idea of meritocracy, a nation that recognizes that every one of us, every one of you has your own unique God-given gift that is distinct from every other person in the world, but that we're the nation where you get to use the maximum of your own God-given gift, whatever that may be, to realize the maximum of your potential. That is the American ethos. And I see that same ethos. You could see it. You could feel it. You could smell it, right? In the ethos of the Bitcoin revolution as well. That's for me the common kinship here, is the idea of belief in choice, belief in freedom.
Well, there you have it.
Yeah.
It's just amazing that from Bitcoin's foundational purpose to its potential role in reshaping economic thinking, it's from one spectrum to the other. You know, what began as a white paper just over 15 years ago has now reached the highest levels of government, and it's influencing how political candidates and business leaders think about money, investment, and even cultural values. It's amazing.
It is amazing. What I liked in that clip, too, is he keeps referring to, you know, your God-given gift.
Yeah.
Your God-given right. Huh?
Meritocracy.
Yeah.
Merit-based.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, whether these visions come to fruition or not, is one thing is clear. Bitcoin has moved from the financial fringes to the center of serious conversations about our economic future. And the coming months will reveal how the U.S. Bitcoin Strategic Reserve develops and what impact it's going to have on the global monetary policy. So the flag has dropped, the gun has shot, and the race has started.
Oh, yeah, for around the globe because, well, we are I think we are the biggest holders of Bitcoin, but still, this is a global thing. You know, that's the whole thing with the financial system and everything. This is the first time in history that it's global. It's not just one or two countries. It's not just the United States and some other country or just the United States. It's everybody. It's all, 229 countries, basically, I think, somewhere in there.
Right.
That it affects.
Yeah.
And can make a big difference in a lot of people's lives.
Yes, indeed. So we've got a few minutes left. Do you want to pivot over to Crypto Codex, or you
sure.
want to talk about inflation?
Well, we can do.
Want to get inflation first?
Sure, let's do inflation.
Well, Anthony Pompliano has a daily newsletter. It's free, by the way, if you want to subscribe to it. It's Pomp at Substack. But remember, it's hard to remember a world before the recent hysteria driven by the market sell-off. So, you know, do your best to try to ignore the noise and don't watch TV, don't listen to these things, don't worry about it. Because everybody was worried about inflation, and they still are. But the latest CPI report came in at 3% year over year. And so what does that mean? You know, the economists were issuing warnings that Trump and his administration were going to make inflation skyrocket because of these tariff policies. No, on the contrary, something else has happened. Now, if you take CPI, it's always a measurement in the past.
I was going to say, it's not real time.
In the past few months, okay? But there's also a real-time index out there called Trueflation, and that is, it measures in real time what's going on now. And there's some interesting information that we need to be concerned about, and I do think that our president is keenly tuned to this. So Trueflation is showing that inflation is right now at 1.39%. So if you read that correctly, we're in a deflationary period of below our 2% target, right?
Right.
Okay. CPI is saying is that we're at 3. But do you want to know what the true inflation rate has been from 2020 to now?
I would have to say it's like a lot higher. I don't know what it is off the top of my head, but we do know, you know, you're probably pushing over 20%.
Yep, you're really close. Trueflation came in and said that it was at 26% inflation, how much our prices have gone up. So back in 2020, a dollar would have bought 74 cents today. So a dollar of goods 4 years ago would only get you 74 cents worth of goods today. So if you look at egg prices, or bacon prices, for instance, we sure do feel the pinch, don't we? But here's the rub. And by the way, CPI said, actually, let me go back. It says Trueflation actually had an inflation report in real time. This is just March right now.
Okay.
At 3.1 in December. Fed CPI is coming in at 3% today. Okay, so we're off. Now, what happens here is if this continues on, and these interest rates stay where they are because the economy is starting to sputter. You're talking about people who are being laid off. Okay. I was calling around today to get some repair prices and people were just clamoring and saying, can you bring it in now? And I'm going, you actually have availability now? Oh yeah. We're trying to keep people working. We were at the home show over the weekend and contractors are going, nobody is buying anything because but we are keeping our prices where they are because we want to keep our guys working. So coming back.
Go ahead. No.
So coming back to this, if the Fed doesn't act, and if they probably won't at the 3% because it would come off at 3% CPI, it would be a perception that if they lower interest rates, that could cause inflation. But if they take Trueflation rates for real time at 1.39%, it's incumbent upon them to lower interest rates.
Yes, they have to.
Now, think about the Trump effect, okay?
Well, they don't have to.
I do believe that Trump knows what he's doing and the reason for the tariff play. So when you do reciprocal tariffs, okay, that is normalizing the market. There will be disruption in our market because, you know, quite frankly, we have been playing under a Keynesian system of a debt credit
right.
or debt-based system. And we have to get away from that. It's not sustainable. So what Trump is trying to do is refinance our debt, our national debt, and he can't do that with interest rates where they are. They must come down, and this is going to put pressure on the 10-year for the yields to go up so that people will buy the 10-year bond so
that's,
we can refinance our national debt because our debt payments are about $1 trillion just in interest.
Yeah.
That is not sustainable. So when all of this happens and interest rates come down, hey, we're off to the races. You're going to find your oil prices going down. The cost of oil is already going down. We're not seeing it in the pump yet, but it is down.
And to, in regards to the tariffs, you know, this is the first time somebody has stood up. You stop and think about before the tariffs, we were always behind the eight ball. We were getting nailed hard. Nobody else was. It was just the United States. None of their chain or tariffs, they were having to, you know, get hit in the belly.
Right.
Now Trump is saying, you hit me in the belly, I hit you in the belly. And they're not going to like it because their stuff's going to get disrupted too.
Well, it's going to help them in the long run too.
Yeah, if they go along with it and get and stop this baloniness.
Unfortunately, they have no choice but to go with it.
Yeah, that's,
but it will benefit them in the long run because it will force them to strengthen,
nicely.
Well, and also to strengthen their own markets. As they should. They should be reliant in their own markets. But in the long run, this is good for us. We're talking about America first and getting our rates down, which will bring prices down. So hang in there. And you know what's going to make that, what's going to happen to Bitcoin? It is going to rise, baby, rise. It is on the way.
Yes, it most
so
definitely
hang in
is.
There.
Yeah.
And so the second half of the year, like we talked about earlier, I'm all in on that.
Yeah. And just look at the price. And don't, you know, get all like, ooh, you know, it's time to buy. It's an opportunity to buy. Just like in any financial market, there is a time to buy and a time to hold, and it's time to buy.
And, you know, that's not financial advice
from a
couple of grannies. I mean, my gosh, you know, what do we know, right?
But like,
don't take it from us, but I would be out there buying, and I am buying.
Yeah, whether, you know, same thing when it was gold, silver, in the financial world. It's not financial advice, but stop and look at the markets, look at the graphs, look what has happened over many a years with gold, silver, and other things.
Yeah, and you should be in it for the long run. If you're
if
you're shortchanging the market and you're trying to make a quick hustle and return, you're speculating, and this is going to be a painful time for you.
Be a hodler. So with that, I think that we're at the end of the show.
Hodler.
All right. All right. Thank you very much.
Week.
We'll see you next time.
Nakamoto, that's the name I love to say. And we don't know much about him, but he came to save the day. When he wrote about the way things are and the way things ought to be, he gave us all a protocol this world had never seen. Or Bitcoin, as you're going into the old blockchain.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.